Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Today's sort of a mental edition.
It is.
We've got a guy talking on garden lunacy.
And saving money in the garden.
And a woman talking about otherwise normal people growing roses.
In a lunacy sort of way. And I think that we're both a little loony today as well.
It's part of the shtick here.
I've got a little bit of a froggy throat, so we make our way through the day today. Yes, Art Walk is joining us. He's going to talk about gardening for pennies, a name that some people may be familiar with here or there.
He's been around quite a bit and lecturing and talking. He's been on national TV a lot on garden shows.
Syndicated column, I think, in some of the bigger papers.
And he's going to talk about, in this day and age, how to save some money gardening, including, we'd hope, the return of the cold frame.
Mm-hmm.
A really handy device that people have gotten away from that we'll talk about a lot more later, but you can use almost any clear plastic or old window wells or whatever.
If you've got a barn, you can find something in it
that
you can make a cold frame out of.
I can make a subdivision of them.
You can extend the growing season. You can start plants from seed, whether they're perennials. Mm-hmm. You can take cuttings and start shrubs.
Yeah.
It really is a useful
tool. It's a little bit, where do babies grow up in?
When they're first nursery?
No, when they first go in after they're born, they go into
a little incubator?
Infirmary, maybe.
An infirmary?
Something like that. Anyway, where do babies go?
I think they go to the nursery, Bob.
Okay. It's like your own little nursery for your own little bitty plants.
There you go. It is indeed.
Thank you.
And let's see, Aurelia Scott. Otherwise, normal people inside the thorny world of rose gardening, competitive rose gardening, I should add. Fun book. She highlights a couple different characters in her research of people that are obsessed with growing roses.
Well, yeah, I mean, the people
it's
that
a whole
collect,
different world.
Collect anything seem to be obsessive and want the very best of anything seem to be very obsessive. And she really gets inside it with some interesting, funny characters and then goes to a national rose show with them and how it all turns out. But the hours and money and time spent just to get the perfect rose would make Shakespeare proud.
You know? Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is pretty cool. And of course, there's interwoven amongst the stories of the characters and the people is the story of the rose. I thought it was interesting. One of the things that she pointed out, Bob, was the fact that traditionally it's always been men that have been a part of these like competitive rose things.
Right.
And even if you look back historically, she noted when she was doing her historical research, very few women were even mentioned in that. And the two that were mentioned were pretty significant. Cleopatra put rose petals everywhere to, tempt Mark Antony. But then who else? Josephine and Malmaison.
Exactly.
And she's sort of credited with catapulting rose hybridization and other interest in rose and sort of eventually that it goes mainstream because of her interest in it. But other than that, it's sort of a man's world in that competitive area. The thorniness, and she equates it to the notion of men sort of trying to conquer or tame or understand the queen of flowers, which in fact is the rose.
That's not fair, but
Oh no, it was beautiful the way that she writes about it. Indeed, it was. I mean, it was a pretty cool story.
And there could be a Hillary Clinton rose someday too.
There could be.
You never know.
There could be. You never know. What's going on in your garden? Speaking of roses, I know you've added more roses to your garden.
Oh my
these
God,
days.
If we added stuff. We got zillions of things out there, but in particular, it's kind of a lesson here. It rained about 12 feet of water. It seemed like in 3 days. And yet, within 2 days, my containers were dry. Mm-hmm. And I think people tend to think around the house, if it rains a lot, the container is going to be wet for a long time. It doesn't matter. Wet is wet and dry is dry, and it'll dry really quick.
When it comes to container,
So as we get into warmer weather here, check your containers on a regular basis. Don't let one rain the next day let you think you can go on for the rest of the week, because you can't.
Yeah.
And to that end, I might have mentioned this before, but we're getting started on this. I've been hauling driftwood out of the Ohio River.
Right.
And making them into little planters.
So it's working.
Hypertufa. Well, so far. We're just getting started on it. I'll keep up with that one, too.
But so how are you, you're hypertufaing over the driftwood?
No, hypertufa is a poor analogy. We're just using driftwood, and they already have a lot of neat little nooks and crannies.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to route out a bigger space, drill a hole so the water will leak out.
Right.
And then I'm going to plant really little sedums and small woodland-type flowers.
Alpine plants
in the driftwood.
Cool.
That'll kind of be a trough extended.
Well, my mom, I remember, she had over the kitchen sink forever, had this little like bromeliad, one of those teeny bromeliads that was pinned to and mounted on pieces of little driftwood.
Yeah.
You know, because they're like epiphytes, so they need air and water. So then, and it was perfect having it at the kitchen sink because then you could spray it with the spray thing.
Yep.
You know, moisten it and then put it back, and that's the trick.
We'll
air and water.
How about the wish estate? What's up?
Well, Bob, I have the official presentation.
Oh, no.
The chickens are in my possession.
Oh, no.
I got my girls.
I'm excited.
I'm so excited,
actually.
Have you
named
them
yet?
Shot in the arm that I needed.
Yeah.
No names, but I do love them already.
Yeah.
My neighbors, Kay and Bradley Yunt, gave us half their flock, so we got a dozen, you know, grown up, all of them laying age.
You got eggs?
Got eggs, babe. Plymouth Barred Rock hens.
Wow.
And here's the official presentation. Four, they don't get any fresher than this. I picked them this morning out of the little nest.
Oh, my God.
And note that you have a chicken or an egg container.
In every pot.
With your name on it. And what you will do is you will take your dozen eggs home. And then you bring back your container. And then I will fill it for you again. But I'm not going to waste containers either.
I know.
You got to reuse your own container.
So would you mind
They're
if
beautiful, aren't they?
Would you mind if I threw out the first egg?
No. I wouldn't, actually. Because there's way more where that came from.
We're going to start the chicken season by throwing out the first egg.
But aren't they beautiful?
They're gorgeous.
I mean, really, it's amazing. The first day we had them, they gave me 7 eggs. Then the second day, they gave me 9 eggs.
Wow.
So, yeah, we'll be
sharing. They're kind of
tannish.
Yeah, they're
nice
light
brown
fawn
eggs.
Brown.
And they're big.
And they're shaped like eggs.
Pretty amazing.
I'm going to hold it up to the light and see if I can see a baby chicken.
No roosters.
No
so
roosters,
there
no chickens.
So there should be no babies.
The yolk's
inside.
On me.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm so happy. I really am happy for it. This is exciting.
It is fun.
We've talked about it and wanted it for years and then...
And here it is. I do. You
eggs.
Like you look at them and you marvel at the fact that they lay these eggs. You go back there and you pick these eggs and we're like, oh my gosh, it's amazing.
How long has that been going on, you think?
Yeah, really. The egg or the chicken, who came first? But if you would like to see a little bit of our trials and tribulations, or mostly just, you know, good things have happened thus far, check out our website because I have included some photos of building the chicken coop and transporting the chickens and collecting our very first eggs.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Good going, girl.
All right, couple of things going on around town, Bob. I do want to remind everybody that Brightside is taking nominations of the 10th annual Fred Wishy Award.
Wow.
It'll be 10 years that we've been doing the award, and sadly, it's also been 10 years that Daddy died. He died in June of 98. But 10 years of the Fred Wishy Award, and we'll be seeking nominations through Friday, May 16th. There are two categories, of course. One is for schools, and the other one is for individuals. The individual receives a beautiful sculpture, but the school has the opportunity to win $3,000, $2,000, or $1,000. So that's pretty significant. And I know that the schools, especially with their environmental programs, can certainly use the help this time. So if you're interested, check out our website for more information on how to nominate an individual or a school for the Fred Wishy Award. That needs to be done by May 16th.
It's a great honor for a great guy.
Yep. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And what else is going on?
Actually, this will be fun, too. The Herpetology Weekend at the Natural Bridge State Resort Park is May 2nd and 3rd in Slade, Kentucky. Good old Slade, Kentucky. They're going to have talks and pictures and probably some film and CDs on amazing amphibians and remarkable reptiles.
All right. And one other thing, coming up Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, May 9th, 10th, and 11th, it's the Locust Grove Gardeners Fair, of course, 10 to 5 on all of those days. But Lamar Gaston at Locust Grove had asked me if I would let our listeners know that they would be delighted to give tickets away to the first 5 callers into Homegrown. You can leave a message on the answer machine and we'll pass that information to Locust Grove and you can get some free tickets to get in. So give us a call at 502-814-8246 and let us know if you want those Locust Grove tickets. And thanks to Lamar and Locust Grove for offering those up.
Mr. Locust Grove.
He's
something. He's fun.
A sweetheart.
Yeah, he's fun.
All right, Bob. Art Wolk, a name that I think people have heard here or there over the years. He's come up with something sort of timely, I think, saving some money in the gardens, gardening for pennies.
Yeah, among his lectures he gives around the country, really, is one about saving pennies in gardening and how you can do things like coal frames and take divisions and the little things that really add up, surprisingly, mm-hmm. When you hear this, how much money you can save. Art's a garden writer, lecturer, and photographer who founded and managed a children's garden in New Jersey for 9 years. He's appeared on the Discovery Channel, Home and Garden TV, and is author of Garden Lunacy, a perfect book, A Growing Concern, with a website by the same title. Art, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I was reading your bio, and you've been a pretty busy guy. I'd like a little background on how you got in this business, and then talk about your garden lunacy concept, which is kind of redundant, actually, I think.
That's pretty good. I first got into gardening through fits and starts when I was very young. I had a teacher that had us grow marigolds for Mother's Day. I used to walk to school every day by a path that had flower bulbs. And then my father rented out our upstairs to an Italian family who raised vegetables that just were incredible.
Right.
And as far as garden lunacy is concerned, I think all of us are a little eccentric, and we also barely fit into the world at large with non-gardeners.
That's true.
A good delineation.
Yeah.
And then the basic premise, the increased cost of everything, and gardeners are looking for ways to save pennies, if not nickels and dollars. So This whole concept developed over how long a period of time, and where did it come from?
Well, originally where it came from was before I found out that I could make more money from speaking, writing, and doing photography, I was raising 5,000 seedlings a year of 100 different varieties of vegetables, annuals, and herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got pretty good at it. And once I got a book out, this is at least 2 decades ago, on how to design flower gardens, I found that when you have a large amount of plants, you can do that. And I also at that time was in charge of a library, and kids 3 to 5 years old used to plant the seeds and transplant them. So if they can do it, anybody
can. Yeah, just barely.
So if we sort of relook at, take another look at gardening today, I mean, as Bob had mentioned earlier, just the economy being a little tighter for people, but there are ways to be a little bit more creative and save money while actually maybe coming out ahead in the long run.
Yeah.
When it's all said and done. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, sure we can. I get into that in my book, Garden Lunacy, where one tomato costs $45,000 when a person grows it.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, there's a lot cheaper ways. Even if you don't think you can grow things from seed, they're a lot easier than you think, especially vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And to get a head start on things, I not only start peppers ahead of time, I also do corn and beans and have them germinate ahead of time.
Wow.
So there's no time wasted.
Sure.
And the other big thing is that you can plant things closer together if you have a soil that's highly organic and dug deep and organic matter is added. It's called double digging.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the main way people can save money is by using things like cold frames. And even if they don't know what that is, if you take 2 window well covers and about 6 clothespins, you've got an instant cold frame.
Oh, yeah.
You do, yeah.
And you can put seedlings out in there as soon as the worst frosts are over. You can extend the season in the spring and later in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's back up a little bit. You mentioned starting corn from seed indoors or in this cold frames. I've never heard of that before. How does that work?
Well, I guess it's because there have been times that I've planted corn and some critters have gotten to the seeds, or maybe it rained too much. If you start them indoors, if you're not having a huge farm worth of corn, if you're growing about 200 or 300 plants, there's no reason you can't start them in flats.
And it just really extends your season a lot longer than you would have otherwise.
Right. Yeah. It means as soon as your last frost date, I go about 2 weeks past my last average frost date, depending on where you live. And I already have plants probably 8 inches tall, ready to go right into a double-dug area.
Mm-hmm, close to
Which means that by late June or very early July, I'm getting nice ears of corn.
Well, let's talk about double-dig, because it is part of the process that enables you to do this. Explain how that works.
What basically happens is you go to your typical area of the garden, and if you have a wheelbarrow, or even if you don't, you dig down about 12 inches and take a swath of soil out, about 11 inches wide, 12 inches deep, put it aside, and then you've got your subsoil, which could be hard clay, or it could be sand, it could be any mixture of the two, And what you do is you add organic matter to it. And I don't mean fresh cow manure, but maybe composted cow manure, or if you have a compost pile, add that, and then dig that into the subsoil. And you gradually go one swath at a time over, and let's say your vegetable bed is 15 feet wide. You do that approximately 10 times, improving the subsoil with lots of organic matter, which breaks down constantly. And what happens is you can actually grow your vegetables closer together. What I found was instead of having corn 12 inches apart, I could have it 8 or 9 inches apart, and would actually have a higher yield than it was previously. I would get 2, sometimes 3 ears of corn on the same stalk.
Wow. And then what equipment is needed indoors to begin these seeds? How would the average person do that?
Basically, I would say I would get a professional mix, and you don't have to be a professional, of course.
Right.
There's lots of different
Pro-mix.
Ones. Pro-mix VX, Sunshine,
right.
Peters has one. It's a sphagnum peat moss-based mix, which they actually have farms of in Canada. You don't have to worry about depleting the world's and then it's a 60-20-20 mix, 60% sphagnum peat moss, 20 vermiculite, 20 perlite, and they have nutrients. And what you do is you can buy flats with inserts in them and start the seeds indoors. And if, even if your temperature is, in the winter, 65 or 68 degrees indoors, they'll still germinate a heck of a lot sooner than they would outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of places on the web people can go to buy this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but it is pretty easy to kind of just use what you have around. I use, heavy plastic, clear plastic bags and cut those open to make like little greenhouses over, you know. So it's
not
like you don't
great.
Have to have the $25 or $35 fancy seed starting kit after all.
Right. It's perfect. There's
yeah.
no reason that can't work.
Yeah. So we can get a head start on the vegetable garden, clearly. What about some of our annuals and perennials? How do we, you know, save some money on improving our mixed borders and our containers?
Here's actually where Glorious Gardens for Pennies come from. I used to go to Longwood Gardens, and I'd come home and look at my backyard and get depressed, which
yeah, right.
is what made me
well,
look
Longwood.
Up the basics of flower garden design. And in flower garden design, you don't put one plant, one plant, one plant of each kind, which ends up looking like clothes in a dryer. Instead, you have groupings of plants, usually in groups that's the shape of a teardrop, so, because the human eye tends to go from the squeezed end to the larger end. And just using that concept of the same kind of plant and using colors that work well together, you can have your garden look dynamic. It's moving, but it's not going anywhere, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But if you understand that concept, you can produce a garden that is glorious.
Visually looks like it's fuller somehow or better looking.
And just one more thing I wanted
sure.
to say. If you can start some of these perennials in the fall, any perennial in Kentucky
mm-hmm.
or the nearabout, if it blooms by the end of June and you start it from seed in September, it will grow all year long in a cold frame as simple as 2 window well covers put together and clothespinned.
And how does that work? You dig it up, dig the plant up. How do you overwinter it?
It's just in there. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll put at the back of it, the front of that cold frame that's window well covers faces south. The back of it on really cold days, what I do is I put pine needles or leaves on top of it to kind of insulate it. But I leave the front end open so sun can get in.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what it does is it gives you a United States Department of Agriculture zone that's higher than where you are.
I guess
if you're at zone 6 or 7, it makes you 7 or 8, and that's why you can grow plants all year long. And people grow things like pansies. They buy them at the market, and they end up 6 inches wide. In a cold frame, if you start them in September, the seeds indoors, and then transplant them outside, in September, by the time spring comes along, those plants are 12 inches across because they like that cool weather.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the danger of the cold frame? Like, if you forget to take the glass off one day and you cook everything, you spend 6 months trying to...
Well, you do have to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
You do. I mean, suppose we have a warm spell and it actually goes up to 70. That does happen sometimes in the winter.
Right.
And if it's going to be 20 or 25 degrees warmer inside the cold frame, those plants will cook.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do, even with something as simple as that window well frame, is I will prop it open but put some weight on the frame so that it doesn't blow away. Normally, the frame is dug into the ground all the way around, but on days like that, there's 2 things you can do. Either open it up in the front, or you can take the clothespins off and open the top, mm-hmm. and then the hot air escapes.
Are there any perennials that work better than others in these things?
The ones that bloom, I'd say by the end of June, they would be things like poppies, delphiniums, lupins, coreopsis. They will grow all winter long.
It's a little earlier in the summer in terms of
bloom. And what happens is, you know, normally if you start something from seed in the spring, you're not going to get anything to bloom the first year.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start these kind of plants in September and cover them with something as simple as a window well cover, you will have plants that will bloom the very first year.
Mm-hmm. So, Art, what about some areas where we can be a little conservative with our consumption of resources, using less expensive fertilizer products, perhaps, or using less water? Are there smart ways to approach that?
Yeah, I think so. First of all, my garden, whether it's the flower garden or the vegetable garden, I always keep mulch on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's breaking down constantly, and of course that adds organic matter to the soil. An organic soil compared to a clay soil will hold 20 times more water, which gets you through drought. And if you have a mulch, it's even better. But I also send my soil to an agricultural extension agent, which most people in the United States have.
Right.
And for about $10 or $12, they will analyze your soil and tell you exactly what kind of nutrients you need to produce the plants you want. Now, most people wouldn't even think of doing this, but, you know, farmers do this all the time. They can't afford to have a bad year. So there's no reason home gardeners can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the mulch adds fertility, and I have compost piles. And the thing with compost piles is to not try to break the world record with it breaking down in 7 days, but to have several going at once.
Right. And there's your free fertilizer, right?
That's right.
And your free mulch, kind of, too, huh?
Yeah, kind of. By the time I'm finished with it, it's pretty much black and crumbly, and that's what I use to improve the subsoil, to double dig.
Have you had much luck in these cold frames in propagating shrubs or dividing shrubs?
Yeah, I have. I've rooted chrysanthemums. I've rooted azaleas. I've rooted lilacs, forsythia, any number of shrubs. If you learn how to root it, there's no reason you can't do that. And some of them grow very quickly.
One last question. Can you estimate in dollar figures how much money you save in a year or a season?
Yes, I actually costed this out when I first gave a lecture of Glorious Gardens for Pennies. And I factored in electricity of starting the seeds inside. And if you start seeds inside and just move things along, what I found was in my backyard, which does look very well, I think, it would cost one-fifth as much to grow things from seed as it did to buy mature plants.
Wow.
That's terrific.
One-fifth the price.
That's a good deal.
Yeah.
Well, Art, thank you very much. I've sure enjoyed talking to you, and we'll recommend your book to all our listeners.
I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Art.
All right. Take care.
Art Wolk is a garden writer, lecturer, and author of the book Garden Lunacy. For information about the book or how you too can save pennies in gardening, visit our homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Aurelia Scott and otherwise normal people inside the thorny world of competitive rose gardening. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And we're moving on
I can smell something good coming out here,
roses.
Actually. Yeah.
Gosh, we've done quite a few interviews with people that have penned books about people being obsessed with certain things.
Yeah, bird watching.
Birds and flowers and different types of things. And I don't know, there's just something about reading the personalities behind these obsessions that fascinate me. And I think the newest book to our collection, Bob, is a good one. It's going to appeal to a lot of folks. Actually, the Louisville Rose Society is mentioned in this book.
And it's got a great title, too.
It does indeed. But we're now joining Aurelia Scott. She's a freelance writer and a master gardener in Portland, Maine. And she's written for the New York Times, Fine Gardening, and Cottage Living, and has just published her first book, Otherwise Normal People,
<That's funny. laughs>
Inside the Thorny World of Competitive Rose Gardening. Aurelia, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Great. It is definitely a fun book, and Louisville is mentioned in it, so that was sort of an extra bonus. Let me ask you first, personally, are you an obsessive gardener type?
I am obsessed about plants.
Okay.
I don't know that I'm obsessed about one plant in particular, but, you know, I must admit to you that although I only grew two roses when I started this book,
yeah,
I definitely grow more than that now.
And may we ask how many?
Well, I wish I could tell you I grew 100, but I do have about 7 roses, and it's creeping up. Mm-hmm. The reason I have, well, it's so few, of course, compared to the people in the book, is because I have a really small garden.
Okay.
I live in downtown in the city.
Okay.
And you don't need counseling yet, in other words.
I don't need, well, I don't know, Bob. I may need counseling, but not for my roses quite yet.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's set the book up. And I'm curious, too, was there a particular moment for you or an experience that you had that kind of gave birth to writing a book about competitive rose gardeners?
Oh, Janine, there absolutely was. It was a man I met here in Portland, Maine, actually.
Uh-huh.
And he knew a bit about roses, and I wanted to learn more. So I went over to visit him. He did not know me and just said, come on over any time to talk about roses,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, I have discovered is what rose people do. They don't need to know you. If you're interested in roses, they're interested in you.
Huh.
And I went over there, and Clarence Rose is fascinated with hybrid teas. And those are wonderful roses, but they aren't hardy necessarily in Maine. So he has struggled with ways to make them survive the Maine winter.
Hmm.
And when we were standing in his driveway, and he explained to me that he grows them in rolling Rubbermaid trash bins in order to be able to move them into his garage over the winter, I thought, wow.
Yeah.
An otherwise normal person.
Hooked. And then he said, and there are more people like me.
Wow. So somebody in your very own community, in fact, and it turns out that Clarence Rhodes is pretty well connected in terms of knowing people across the country that are involved with competitive rose gardening. So was he sort of your, I mean, you said that rose people are pretty welcoming to whoever, as long as you're interested in roses, but was he kind of your entree into the rest of the world?
Yes, he was. He was marvelous in terms of his welcome. He introduced me to a couple of people, and they would introduce me on, and, mm-hmm. and that is the way it worked. My research was really being led by the hand from one person to the next. Although I have to say, I always had Clarence sort of right over my right shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
All you really have to do in the world of roses is mention the name Clarence Rhodes, and someone will have heard of him.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So that was a wonderful boom.
Yeah, you've got a bouquet of characters, for lack of a better word, in this book, but tell our listeners a little bit about, I mean, you're in South Carolina, you're in Connecticut, you're in California, you're, you know, touched on Texas. Kind of give us a quick trip of how many stops you had in this book.
Well, I had probably about 10 different stops that I made. Northern California and Southern California, Texas, up in the Midwest, throughout New England, and as you say, down in the Carolinas. I never got myself down to the Florida and Georgia area, although I have heard, and I'm not trying to make a joke here, it is a hotbed of rose gardening down there, but it's a sort of a different world of rose gardening. But I learned that there is much affection between rose gardeners. I mean, they all know they're crazy and they're in this together,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time, I learned that there's a lot of competition among rose gardeners. Among those who go to these national competitions, certainly, and even among people who don't, everybody who grows roses really thinks they do it the best or their kind of people do it the best.
You'd hope so. Well, two of the people mentioned, of course, are Phil and Rachel Hunter, and her interest in roses kind of grew in Louisville. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, that's right. She had actually started out in California, and they were reassigned to Louisville. She joined the Rose Society, she figured, as she said, just to figure out how to grow roses in a place where there's winter. And then once she learned that, she would just bail, and that would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not how it worked out. She got hooked on what these people were doing. They were growing the most gorgeous roses. and she wanted to learn more. A lot of it does involve a lot of horse manure, by the way. That's one of her favorite things.
Oh, yeah.
And then what happened is a friend told her, you really have to come see a Rose show. She hesitated for a long time. Finally, she was convinced. She saw those roses, and she thought, I grow roses just as gorgeous as that, which is, by the way, what happens to a lot of folks. Yeah. And then the next show, she went, and, you know, she won an award for Best Novice, and that's all it took.
Yeah.
One award, and she was hooked.
So let's talk a little bit about the show culture. All of these people are doing it, you can't quite figure out why, because there is no why, I don't think.
That's right. There's no money in it.
There's no money in it, and they spend all this time so that they can cut a stem and try to win at the Rose Show. So, you know, talk about what that Rose Show culture is like. And, I mean, even, Aurelia, if you can, what an experience would be like from planting a rose bush to caring for it to cutting it to refrigerating it to actually transporting it and getting it to a show. Okay. I mean, what's really going on?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what the most addicted do. Because you could plant one rose bush and try to get something to a show, but we all know that nature doesn't always work with us. So that you might not necessarily manage to get a gorgeous, show-worthy rose blossom to a show. A lot of these folks will grow 15 plants of the same variety mm-hmm. that they want to show.
Wow.
And they will plan ahead of time for knowing that a show is going to be coming up in June, 2 years from now. And when do I want my roses to look at their very peak, just about to open in totally.
Right.
And so they plan ahead, and the planning ahead includes when they fertilize their roses, when they prune their roses. It's all a matter of staggered pruning, remember, so that the rose is at its peak when the judge walks by.
Wow.
And so several days ahead of time, they will cut all the possible blossoms off their rose bushes that they will take to that show. You can always tell a competitor's garden, which is the garden in which just before the roses look gorgeous, they cut
They're
all
gone.
The roses off the bushes. And they package them up in all kinds of devices that they have built in suitcases and styrofoam boxes, and either drive too far, or some of them even fly too far, to the shows. Those who drive tend to drive through the night with the air conditioning on, even if it's winter, to try to keep the roses as cool as possible.
Wow.
And they'll get to a show, and most shows are judged around 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. And so they have to have submitted their roses for judging by, say, 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So, working backwards, a lot of these folks will start what they call grooming their roses, slowly opening petals, making sure that there's no dust on the leaves, just making what is already perfect look even more perfect. They will start that process at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and work for hours the way some people who go to dog shows work on their dogs.
Right.
These folks are working on their roses. You are not allowed to add anything to a rose, but mm-hmm. you can take off anything you want.
Huh.
So you could take off an offending petal, say, or take off any dust or thorns that sort of get in the way. Mm-hmm. And there are many, many categories in which the roses are judged. So all kinds of people in this ice-cold room, usually with bright, bright lights on, are sweating over their delicate blossoms, and then they put them in the show and try to go find a place to have breakfast and not think about who's going to win.
Think about what's going to happen at the end of the day. So, what is the perfect peak rose? Is it close? Is it slightly open? Is it open?
It's open between a half and three quarters.
Okay.
Traditionally, all of this is in a whole set of really thick rule books.
Mm-hmm.
But the type of rose that can win Queen of Show, which is the best, is hybrid tea. So any kind of hybrid tea variety can win the Queen of Show. And that's why a lot of the folks who compete nationally. personally tend to grow a lot of hybrid tea roses. But increasingly, there are more and more categories for old garden roses, which I know are increasingly popular. I mean, we all love the scent that old garden roses have and the history of them.
When it's all over, do gunfights break out or lingering animosity, or how do these people get along?
A lot of tension breaks out in that room. Yeah. There's, they're armed, if you will. They they have clippers and very sharp scissors, and I've never heard of actual blood being drawn, but there's certainly shouting matches, and there's corners where there's a lot of tension between people, and there are certainly people who, shall we say, do not groom their roses in the same parts of the room.
You have to keep them separate.
That's right. There's a lot of argument that goes on, but what's curious about this sort of competition is that tomorrow's judge may be today's competitor, and today's competitor, tomorrow's judge. I mean, these people know each other intimately, even if they only ever see each other at rose shows. So while there are, yes, some people who have ended up, to be honest, hating each other's guts, there are a lot more people who have had almost knockdown, drag-out fights and then learned to live with each other.
Yeah. But more so, it seems, or at least that's what I got from the book, most of these people do like each other, and there's a good, healthy sort of interaction and partnership and cooperation and swapping of ideas and such.
There is. I like to think it's the influence of the Queen of Flowers, the rose. Who knows? But she's over 34 million years old, you know, so that's how long the rose has been around on the earth.
Wow.
And she may have learned a thing or two in all of those years to pass on to the human beings that she has addicted.
Well, what do these rose gardeners think of we who grow like the knockout? Is that, are we looked down upon, or is that an entree into maybe a more significant rose later on in our lives?
You,
the knockout is so easy.
That is what they really want. It's not looked down upon. Now, a lot of them will say, well, they don't want to grow knockout because precisely the reason why you and I like to grow knockout,
right.
Because it's
easy.
So easy.
Yeah. They want the challenge.
They want a challenge, that's right. And at the same time, though, they want you addicted.
Yeah.
They want to get you hooked.
One of the things that you talk about, too, the challenge, the hybrid tea that most everybody grows, that is one of the most difficult roses to grow because of insects and disease and other sorts of things. But like the inventions and the contraptions and the concoctions and all the things that the people come up with and invent and exchange of ideas are fascinating. It's part of, I think, you know, conquering, you know, the elusive queen. You talk about some of these, the more interesting innovations that have come?
Sure. One of the ones that I saw very early on and didn't really understand the significance of until later was invented or improved upon by Clarence Rose, the man who started me here in Portland. It's a bloom protector. And the way it works is it's a 2-gallon clear plastic juice container that he has cut part off of and attached to a pole that he can then slide into the ground beside the rose bush and slide this clear plastic down over a bloom that he wishes to protect until he gets it to the rose show.
Wow.
So it's to keep it protected from all kinds of weather.
Uh-huh.
And in some of these gardeners' gardens, particularly one fellow I went to see in the Carolinas, Satish Prabhu, right before a rose show, his garden, it looks like some space age thing. His garden is just full of gorgeous roses, but they all have weird plastic contraptions over the most gorgeous blossoms. So that is something they do. Another fellow I met, he wants to protect some of his roses that have a tendency to sprout really early, but then get damaged by a late frost.
Mm-hmm.
So he slides PVC pipe down over individual canes of a rose.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at this rose growing up, say, beside his house, and what it just looks like is a whole bunch of PVC pipe sprouting from his garden bed.
Amazing.
It is. It is amazing. I think that that is part of the delight, and you were touching on that, Janine, the challenge of trying to grow perfection in partnership with and competition with Mother Nature, mm-hmm. who doesn't always make it easy for us. So part of it is learning to create all kinds of contraptions that have you succeed. And at the same time, what I found so fascinating about many of the people I met is while they are battling Mother Nature in many ways, they are impressed by her. Mm-hmm. And when things don't work out and say your garden is just decimated one year, no matter what you have done, there is fury on their parts and also a sense of honoring, well, mm-hmm. that's what nature mm-hmm. did to me.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Well, do they lose sense of the love of gardening and for the competition? Do they ever walk around at sunset and enjoy their gardens, or they're too busy worrying about that perfect flower to enjoy that?
Well, it's a matter of perspective. I thought when I first met them that they were too busy walking around their gardens, working hard on their gardens to enjoy it in the way that I think of enjoying a right. rose. But I had a couple of them say, no, Aurelia, that's not true. Working with my roses is my way of being with my roses.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I'm deadheading and I'm pinching out and I'm pruning, but it's my way of communing. And you know, Bob, they really do, so many of them commune intimately with these plants.
Right.
They really notice them. And that was a lesson that I learned as a gardener. So often I resent the chores that I do in my garden and keep wanting to find a day when I can just sit down and relax and look at it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that really the chores are your way of being with your plants.
Yeah,
and
getting to understand them and know them a little bit better too,
exactly.
ultimately.
Exactly.
Aurelia, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. It's a great book. It was a good read.
Thanks so much. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Aurelia Scott is a writer and gardener in Portland, Maine, and the author of Otherwise Normal People, Inside the Thorny World of Competitive Rose Gardening, published by Algonquin Books. Of course, for more information, you can see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
And we've got some questions.
We do.
And I'm going to start with this one, Bob.
Okay.
Because it sort of echoes a little bit of what we talked about with Mr. Wolk earlier with cold frames, but this one concerns a raised bed. David P. from Jeffersonville writes that he just moved to Jeffersonville from Tucson, Arizona, so kind of green at the gardening thing in this part of the country.
No.
But in his backyard, there's some issues in terms of like their lateral lines, so they're going to do some raised beds for their vegetable garden, and he was wondering if that was something that we thought was a good idea, and we certainly do.
Yep.
He was planning on building the boxes out of 2x6s or 2x8s and then filling the individual beds with compost and soil. His questions are, what kind of mixture for the beds would you recommend in terms of compost soil? Do you think building the beds out of 2x6 lumber would be okay? And do you have any other suggestions for planting a garden in this type of area?
Yes. Yes and yes.
Okay. Yes. I would do like a half and half mix of composted manure, you know, whether, you know, wherever you can get it from, but and then some good topsoil. So the balance of that is going to be nutrients, but also the soil density that you need and the good drainage that you're going to need as well. I think in southern Indiana, you can get some compost soil mixtures already from some of those places.
Yeah,
so that may be
an
option.
Yeah, be real careful because they're never the same 2 weeks in a row, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
It's not these big commercial places sell soil and ground up stuff, and I've had mixed results with it at best. So
right.
You're almost better looking at it.
First. Right. Look at it and make sure that it's a soil compost mixture, not a mulch mixture. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And then in terms of building the beds with 2x6 lumber, that would be okay. I would not use treated lumber just because of the leaching of what they treat lumber with, and if it's a vegetable garden, I wouldn't do that. 2x6s or 2x8s, yeah, absolutely. I would do a couple, I would do it a little bit deeper than 6 inches, so you might need two boards, but yeah.
Well, any boards you get are going to rot unless they're treated, but you can also use like cement blocks or cinder blocks or things like that.
Right.
For the edging, and that'll totally eliminate any problem with worrying about the...
And some wood's going to rot a lot faster than other, but I would be very careful about not getting... Some of the, I don't think they use arsenic anymore, but they use like chromiated other stuff to treat wood, and that leaches into your vegetable garden. Right. It's not a good idea. Other suggestions in terms of planting a garden of this type. Honestly, if you make a series of kind of smaller beds, like 4x5s, and you can kind of grid them out, that may be fabulous, because then that way you'll have more space. You can add to it as the years go by, and you can clearly rotate your crops from one raised bed to the next as the years go on, and that'll help you with pest management.
And something we've learned with our raised bed is that it's going to sink 2 or 3 inches a year, as it'll keep decomposing a little bit.
Right.
So just prepare the next year to add some more. And
which is great, because then you can add more compost.
Oh my God, it drains so well. It's almost, it's like a straw almost. Yeah. Whoosh, it's just wonderful.
It's nice.
Yeah.
All right, one more question, Bob. Yeah. This one is from Carol Frederick. A while back, there was a discussion of hydrangeas, she says, but she can't remember all of the recommendations. So she's asking us what we think of the variety Matilda Gutskis, I guess.
Gutskis. I'm hoping you're going to pronounce that better than me. Cause,
Gutskis.
Yeah. It's an old one, old favorite, actually.
Old favorite.
Yeah.
Macrophylla. This is where she wants to plant it, so this is good information. She's going to plant it at the low end of a deck. It's southern exposure, but it's slightly under a large maple tree.
Yeah, the macrophyllas can be a problem in a late frost, because it'll kill the blooms. You don't get any buds. But southern exposure and some mulching and watching and carefully and covering it in the late frost, you should be fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful hydrangea. It's got this incredible blue flower that... my favorite blue in the plant world, and there's not much of it. So it's a good choice.
And if you want it to be really beautiful blue, like Bob said, make sure your
acid
pH is low and it's acid. If you want it to be more pink, it can be high and more.
Exactly.
It is one of those old-time favorites for sure. Good choice.
Yeah. If you have a blue question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 502-814-8246. Miss Wishy, today's Latin word is sometimes used to describe me.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, that's surprising.
I don't know why.
Must be something to do with age. Who knows?
It does, actually.
Latin word of the week. Yeah, and it's earned, right? Latin word of the week is aculita, aculitum, or aculitis.
It means prickly.
It means prickly.
Go figure.
I was inspired by the whole rose story, of course.
Yeah.
And prickly suggests thorns, whether they are robust or spiny and small. A couple of examples. Arenaria. Aculeata.
Prickly sandwort.
Prickly sandwort. That describes you perfectly.
That sounds like a crab or something.
It does.
Crawling around.
Acrocomia aculeata.
I love this one. The macaw palm.
Macaw palm.
I can just see the bird up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the shape of it,
thorns on the base of the palm. On the,
thorny.
Aphanes, Aphanes. Aculeata.
Ruffle palm.
Again, with kind of thorns on it, the spine, but then the palmy leaf part is ruffly.
Yep.
Cleome aculeata.
The prickly spider flower.
I mean, and who hasn't gone to pick some cleome for a vase and then realize they have huge thorns on them?
And I forget that every year.
Yeah.
Like every year.
Yeah. It is surprising. You don't expect it.
Doesn't
they look
like
far
it.
Too dainty for that. Phlox aculeata.
The sagebrush phlox.
Sagebrush phlox.
Well, if that rolls and hits you in the butt, you'll...
Oh, yeah. No kidding. Stay on your horse. Ruscus aculeatus.
The old butcher's broom.
Butcher's broom. I'm curious to know what butcher's broom looks like.
Yeah, it cleans your floor
broom.
Scratches at the same time.
Yeah, butchers some of your stuff, too, I guess.
Yeah.
Polystichum aculeatum.
The old prickly shield fern.
Who knew that there was a fern out there that had prickles on it?
I don't want to be anywhere near it.
I don't either.
My Uncle Edgar was pretty prickly, too. So
was he?
He's probably a little Aculeata.
Okay. I can think of a bunch of people that are Aculeata, Aculeatum, or Aculeatus.
You got it.
And indeed, it does suggest that something about the plant is prickly.
It's not.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, who needs derby when you have Naked Gardening Day? We'll have the story for you next week.
She said Naked Gardening Day, folks. Come back for that one. Homegrown is produced by the perpetually placid Brad Yost and the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.